I decided to give this little session a title so that you will know what it is I wanted to talk about. And that will then give me the liberty of talking about anything that I would like to talk about. And of course, in the process of giving a title, I now have come up with three titles. And here are the three titles. The Citizenship and Politics of Planetary Humanism, title one. That's a no-no. The second title is The Governance in the Planetary Culture. A little better. And the third one, I think you'll all agree with, is The Boy with the Finger in the Dike. I hope to talk about the first two, but I'm likely to be talking like the third one. In order to do that, because I have a rational, methodical mind at a certain level of B to B plus, I've got four categories that I would like to center this discussion about. The first is what I will call the sociology of this conference. The second is what I will call, in pretentious terms, the sociology of knowledge of the world order perspective, or the Institute for World Order. The third is some preferred worlds, and the fourth is some transition proposals. And I now begin with the sociology of this conference. And I begin with the statement which is obvious to all of you, that thus far the speakers have been male, white, over 40, all of whom have graduated and have PhDs or that the functional equivalent from Western universities, very well trained. There are no blacks. There are no third worlders. And that comment is generally made in a kind of a snide way to criticize the conference and the people who organized it. And that is not what I intend to do. Because I find, well, let me start with the blacks and the third worlders. If you invited them, they probably would not come. They don't want to be here.
Which happened to us?
It's not their thing. They don't know, you know, don't annoy us. If you would leave us alone so that we could get our own dignity and our heads together, as you guys put it, as they would say, we would be better off. So that in some sense, the failure or the absence of these people, despite the fact that I spend most of my life trying to involve myself with them, the failure, their absence here shouldn't be immediately seen as a negative, and perhaps we should make a virtue of it. And I'll see how we might do that. Secondly, I would say the fact is that most of the people who are in this room, I would suspect most of us are all college trained, even the children. we've gone through that kind of schooling. And I would guess there isn't anybody in this room who hasn't been outside continental USA. That is, if we did a frequency distribution of this room, I would be surprised if we find one person who hasn't left the United States and probably hasn't gone across the Atlantic or the Pacific. That would surprise me very much. And that, I therefore make the point that we are the privileged class. We are part of that privileged class of the global community. And when we talk about place and we talk about establishing roots, we are part of the Homeric aspect of humankind as well. We have gone through our adventures. And when we talk about establishing roots in a particular place, it's only because we've been to Nairobi and Santiago and Peking, and coming back and establishing ourselves here is because we have a sense of the anthropology and the globe in a way that other people don't ordinarily get it. Okay. Now that, I take it, part of the sociology of the conference is then that we are global citizens already. We have made ourselves. By getting the passports and the visas and traveling, we have imposed ourselves and made ourselves into global citizenship. And citizenship implies responsibility. And that's why I want to talk about that kind of responsibility that it imposes upon us. And it seems to me that we begin with the responsibility that since we are already globally informed because we have been there and we have seen it and we've talked about it, we talk about global culture with a feeling about it because we have experienced it and helped create it by bringing Scotch whiskey and Bach and the Beatles to to wherever we went, and Christ, and Christ knows what else we have brought to wherever else we have gone. Now, therefore, I am, instead of criticizing this conference, the sociology of the conference, I find a good deal to be said for it, and I find it in a very personal way, in the sense, for me at least, the people I have been meeting at this conference turns out to be my third world and fourth world. I have spent a good deal of my time in the last 10 years running around the globe meeting people in academic communities and some policy elite in other nation-state systems. And by and large, they are like myself. They have gone through Western-trained universities. They know all the rhetoric. They drink the same liquors. They have the same heroes and villains, by and large. And meeting John Ford, or meeting Stuart again, or even Bill, who is part of that same culture, that is, this meeting of people who are ratiocinating on a global problem, present technocrats with some kind of a technocratic view, meeting with the people who are establishing some new lifestyle, is for me meeting the third world in my own sort of quote society. I very rarely meet them abroad, and therefore for me it is a very meaningful experience. And that moves me then to my second topic, which is what I will call the world order methodology and the Institute for World Order, or the sociology of knowledge. And here, one other precedent which I will follow, which was established by the previous male speakers, is that each of them sort of gave a statement of their faith and a little bit of their background. And I, as a good lawyer, will follow the precedent, unless I have reason not to. And I want to say a little bit, because I think it was, while it's a little cloyy and embarrassing to talk about one's own project, it's disingenuous not to do so. And I therefore want to talk a little bit about how the Institute got started and what we thought we were about and why we are now here. The Institute for World Order is what we call in the United States a research educational foundation, which was organized in the early 1960s by Harry Hollins, who's sitting back there, and his wife Betsy, actually, in conjunction with a man by the name of Grenville Clark. And they were informed by a view, as I was when I joined them 6 months later, that it was possible to eliminate war as a human institution. That is to say, we took seriously the way abolitionists must have done sometime between the 17th and the 19th century in various parts of the globe, that you might abolish slavery as a human institution, and then went about establishing a global movement for doing so, spreading from Denmark, et cetera, et cetera. We took seriously that we were at an 1810 period with regard to large-scale organized violence, and that it might be possible, if the appropriate strategy was brought to bear on that problem, that we might in fact be able to do something about that. The organization had another vision. It was informed by a view which we all in this room would call world federalism. And it was informed by a really genuinely great human being, a man by the name of Grenville Clark, who wrote a book called World Peace Through World Law, which is the federalist model for a limited world government. And that book and its author has a history which is sometimes, it might be worth your learning about. But what it amounted to was that Clark, who devoted his life from 1945 to the 1967, was he died? I believe, he devoted those 20-some years to two enterprises. One was the assistance in the civil rights movement, and he was one of those people who gave a good deal of money anonymously to establish the the Legal Defense Fund of the NACP. But his sort of more public side was trying to engage responsible people throughout the globe in this enterprise of abolishing war as a human institution. And the books which he wrote, A Plan for Peace in 1951, World Peace Through World Law in 1956, with revised editions coming out since that time through 1967, were an attempt to engage both the political elite structure and moral authority figures throughout the globe in the notion that it was possible to transform the present system of military unilateral decision-making on the part of nation-states into some kind of a federal system where war had been eliminated and we had other institutions to handle claims, grievances, conflicts, and the redistribution of some income. And in 1960, he was told by his doctor that he had a form of cancer and that it was likely he would not live through the year, that his chances of living more than a year were like 1 out of 3, and he called upon Harry Hollins, who was then in Wall Street selling bonds, to come up to his home with Bethany, and they discussed the problem of how they might carry on the educational work which he was engaged in, which consisted in seeing heads of states, writing to the authority figures throughout the globe, and trying to get them involved in this kind of an enterprise. And they hit upon the notion that what they would do, well, let me, to encapsulate, what they had in mind, stating it in the kind of terminology that comes out of universities, is that the present policy elite throughout the globe, like most of the citizens of the world, were involved, encapsulated in the paradigm of the nation-state system from the 16th to the 20th century, that there was no considerable pressure group for breaking that system, that we had come to a point where the human race might destroy itself, and we needed a strategy for breaking through. And what they thought was, if we can't get the policy elite educated to it, then why don't we establish pressure within societies to demand the kind of bold leadership that will be necessary for drastic system change, to move the system. And they embarked on a worldwide educational project. That is to say, the strategy was, what we had to do was to really get cells of people throughout the globe, the way Christianity or communism or any great social movement starts, with some kind of educational process going around the issues that were involved in drastic system change, with the one important notion that you gave a vision of what that drastic system would be if you got there. At least begin to think about that. Now, what occurred in the process of thinking through that is they began with an adult education program. And they conceived of, therefore, establishing adult education groups all over the world who would begin to take seriously this notion. And in the process of a dialogue with an assistant professor at Rutgers, namely me, who had taken on one of these adult education courses because I needed the $500. We were on our second child who's sitting back there smirking at me. And and because I had just come back from Harvard where I'd had a visiting year with Louis Sohn and had become intrigued by the incredible mosaic that was to be found in this book, World Peace Through World Law, which is one of the dullest books in the history of humankind for anybody who doesn't see what is singing behind it. Because it's written in a constitutional form. On one side you have the UN Charter, on the other side, like any good lawyer, you have a revised charter, and in between you explain why the words on the right-hand side are different from the words on the left-hand side and what the meaning of that would be. And that takes somebody who wants an A in constitutional law to read very carefully. Although, in fact, having said that, it turns out there have been lots of people throughout the globe who found it an attractive enough siren so that they have read it and incorporated it into their souls. Their thought, if they could get adult education started on that and get enough people involved in it, they would begin to get that kind of pressure that was necessary to change the policy elite. And I got involved in that project, and I came back and discussed this with them, and we hit it then upon a following political strategy. So we knew we were in politics to begin with, and this is the politics of one particular movement, one particular contribution to the establishment of planetary culture and the governance therein. We decided that we needed a 10-year period to infiltrate the academic establishments of the globe with what we then called war prevention as a discipline. And what we thought we would do is we create a discipline with all the academic paraphernalia around it that would meet academic standards, which would supplant the traditional international relations, international organization, and comparative law. I want to make something very clear about that. We made the decision that we were going to work within existing institutions. We did not expect to change those institutions. That is, we weren't going to de-school. We weren't going to change the curriculum, well, except we were going to change the substantive way people looked at problems. And we then embarked upon this project, and we took the book, World Peace Through World Law, and we asked of that constitutional model for a new world system. The suggestions which are being offered by the authors Clark and Sohn, because Lewis Sohn of Harvard was a co-author of that book, are the suggestions which they're offering, are they necessary to eliminate war? Are they feasible, and are they fair? Now, obviously, in any social problem, those are always interrelated, but we thought for analytical purposes we would divide out the three. And we put a set of materials around them, and we began introducing them into the universities. And within a period of about 3 or 4 years, we had some 250 universities who were using the materials, and we were then part of that, what is now known, the peace studies movement. So that today in the United States, there are a minimum of 400 colleges that now have peace studies courses. There are a minimum of 100 universities and colleges which actually have peace studies programs, in the sense that there are two or more courses around that kind of a topic. And there are 10 places in the United States where you can actually get an undergraduate or graduate degree in something like nonviolence or peace studies or world order kind of methodology. And we are in the process of establishing some 15 world order centers. And here I want to get into the methodology and why I've now moved from war prevention to the term world order. Knowing that the enterprise we were engaged in was politics, and knowing that what we had to do was change not only the minds of the people in the United States and define the problem differently here, but that it was global, we began traveling in 1962 and 63 to various parts of the globe to find out what sorts of things were taking place in academic institutions and in schools throughout the globe in these problems, and discovered much as what we had discovered in the United States, which we'd done a similar survey, that there were very few places where there were formal academic subjects on the matter, but that there was a great latent interest in it, and that there, if the appropriate instructional materials could be gotten together, perhaps we might be able to do something there. And so we then began trying to identify and recruit people, and I think John Ford made an excellent point last night. We began recruiting people for our problem. That is to say, we didn't go and say to them, it was your problem. We said, we are a number of American citizens, U.S. citizens, who are very concerned by the fact that there may be thermonuclear war. We are concerned that the human race may not survive, but we are certain we will not survive. Our problem is the elimination of war. We didn't lay it on them. It was our problem, okay? Now, in the process of learning and teaching and finding out in dialogue, we had a number of seminars, some of which were quite helpful, some in New Delhi. We had one in Dar es Salaam in 1966 where we brought together some 8 East African states, some academics, some policymakers, some journalists, and in the process of going through what was to have then been a 2-week seminar, discovered some 50% of the participants were unwilling to read the materials, because the U.S. group who came, despite the fact that we had 2 black Africans as part of the, quote, resource group, the U.S. people were considered to be either straight-out CIA agents or dupes and carrying on neo-imperialism under a guise that we just ourselves did not understand. And therefore, they were not about to take that material seriously. And in 2 weeks, you get to know one another, and within those kind of parameters, we got to like one another and all that. Nevertheless, they never did take quite seriously what it was we were talking about. We came back home. We started to think about that, and it was Harry Hollins who said to me one day in the office, supposing they had their own model of world order, supposing they had their own model of war prevention, maybe that would make it differently. And that's how the sort of World Order Models Project sprang up, because what we dreamt of was the following. Supposing we asked groups of scholars in various parts of the world to produce their own constitutional models, as it were, of world order, and put them then together along a row, and then we might have, if not the Federalist Papers, the pre-Federalist Papers for a global community, the governance of a global community. And so we embarked on that crazy venture. And we thought it would take us a year and a half and $150,000. It is now 7 years later, and I suppose it cost us $600,000 or $700,000. And the books are about to come out in January through July of next year. And we are now, therefore, going to leave the academic community, and we are entering politics, unless the Internal Revenue Service is listening, because we're tax deductible. That is one of the reasons we are here. That is, I now come both to the sociology of the conference and to why we are here, is because we now want to leave the academic community. It is not that we want to leave it behind, and that enterprise, we're going to generate a lot of people in that academic community, because that's politics. What is considered, as everybody's been saying here, what Kuhn has been saying in the structure of scientific knowledge, what people consider to be an appropriate problem, what they consider to be an appropriate solution, obviously determines the world, and you don't have to be solipsistic to believe that the solid facts of social life are frequently in the imagination. And what we imagine frequently is what comes out for ourselves. Now, I'd like to say something about how the world order methodology emerged out of that 7 years of experience with these group of fellows from throughout the globe. Because when we first went to them and we said, we're interested in your assistance on working on war prevention, while the Western Europeans and the Soviets understood what we were talking about, it's obvious to those of to you immediately, but it wasn't to us because we were naive. The people in Africa and Latin America and India said, nonsense, that's not our problem. We understand it is our problem, but our problems are bread and indignity, poverty and injustice. Now, if you want to talk about poverty and injustice, we'll talk about war. And as we began to work that out, we began to think of ourselves as dealing with poverty, war, and injustice rather than just war. One is the compelling ethical reason. That is, people who are in those straits, obviously you want to help. Secondly, there is, after all, the causal connectedness. Most of the major wars of the world come out of the fact that there is poverty and indignity. And therefore, if you're really going to take seriously as a causal matter how you're going to eliminate war, then as an analytical, an intellectual matter, you have to have that in. So it wasn't a very difficult thing for us to then say, okay, these are the problems. And having thought that way, that these were the problems, we then began to ask ourselves, well, what is the kind of perspective we will use on this? And that's where we decided that what we were interested in is the following. We were going to take the problems of large-scale organized violence, war, poverty, and social injustice, and we were going to try to create a system in which those three were handled in some acceptable minimal conditions for people throughout the globe within a time span between the time we began, let's say 1967-68, but someplace in the decades in the 1990s. And our thinking, our reasoning about this was twofold. First of all, we had a diagnostic view, which Dick Falk suggested this morning. Even then we had that diagnostic view, that we did not have more than somewhere between 10 to 20 years to avoid the set of catastrophes that were upon us. And therefore, there was a sense of urgency that it could not hold off until 2050. And secondly, in putting it in the somehow decade 1990s and in selecting people who then were under 40, who are now over 40, we thought we were doing two things at the same time. We were taking ourselves out of the present circumstance so that we didn't have to try to come up with a solution to each present problem, whether it was the Vietnam War or South Africa or whatever it was. But we did not put ourselves in a position so far down the line that we would not be responsible for the recommendations which we were about to make. Because whenever you present a model of a preferred, as we came to call it, a preferred world, you're obviously making recommendations. Now, the methodology then became quite simple. We asked each of them to do a diagnostic prognostic statement for the period of time between now and sometime in the middle 90s. Having done that diagnostic statement, we asked them to go through what we call a range of relevant utopias. And by relevant utopias, we had a rather technical meaning. We did not mean that it was politically feasible. What we meant by the term relevant was, is that you stated your transition process, not merely your utopia, how the problems would be solved in some other system, but what was the manner in which you would move from the present system to that system. And the relevance was the fact that you stated it in sufficiently behavioral concrete terms so that somebody reading it could get some sense, a subjective probability of an aha feeling, or no, that's just out of the question. And then after you went through a range of relevant utopias, you stated your preferred world. What is the preferred world that you really want, and that included your recommendation for how you would get from the present system to that preferred world, taking into account each time that when you looked at either the war, the poverty, or the social injustice issue, you had to take the other two into account at the same time, that it was an organically set of related variables. Now, I move very rapidly now into the preferred world, but I want to make one statement about that, and that is, in saying that the problems are war, poverty, or social injustice, it's obvious we must have had a set of values that led us to say that they were problems. That is to say that something is a social problem means you have a value in your head, a normative statement about the way things ought to be, or you wouldn't call a thing a social problem. So we had as values peace, social justice, and economic well-being. I use the term well-being now because I want the term welfare has a connotation of somehow a handout. And I use the term economic well-being because I want every individual throughout the globe to have the right, the legal right, for minimal subsistence, and I will use well-being to do that. Now, we had in mind, therefore, those values, or we could not have seen those social problems. One of the methodological, or perhaps spiritual, or I don't know how to call it, one of the things we tried to do as we went through this exercise, and that may be the little thing in the dike, if it turns out to be a political program, then it will be a manifesto. One of the things we tried to do was concretize, incarnate, operationalize what we mean by the terms war, poverty, and social justice, and what we mean. What would it mean to have peace? What would it mean to have social justice? What would it mean to have economic well-being? To state them in sufficiently concrete terms so that people who were involved in our movement, as we all are, would have targets we could shoot for. That it would not then be pie in the sky. It's pretty technocratic, but is there some way of stating the damn thing so we know when we've arrived there, what it is, you know, that we're at some part of the journey. We've come half. It's like the community chest. Are you 50% up on that thermometer or not? Well, you would like to know whether you're getting there or not. So one of what I consider to be the clarifying things that occurred in this thing is that we really did try to establish some sense of the concreteness. Now, there's no sense in my trying to summarize 8 different documents because I'm not going to do them justice and they don't all therefore come out. I can, in the process of our discussion, give you my own views of what those should be, what those standards concretely should be. But I want to say that I think the point I want to make about preferred worlds is you should get pretty concrete and behavioral about what it is you're shooting for. I sense in talking to many of the quote kids, i.e. the college students who have gone through and are now looking for something meaningful to do, who are lost and are in limbo and are sort of floating around, moving from job to job, that kind of thing, is that one of their failures to find an appropriate job is that they lack a vision of what it is they really want. I mean, they want to be decent people, they want to feed the poor, they don't like it that there's apartheid in South Africa, they goddamn wish Nelson Rockefeller had not shot those people in Attica, but they do not have a vision of where it is they want to go. And so I feel very strongly that one of the things that, and it may be the kind of thing a Lindisfarne or the New Alchemist can really do, is as they give us alternative lifestyles, give us incarnate type models of a vision of a world we might want to live in. And that's, one doesn't have to be Gutenberg about it. One could see how it happens. One could then TV it and show it to people. But at least we must have some particular visions. And here, then, I want to introduce, as we go into the preferred world, I want to introduce another kind of what I will call tension or dialectic in what has been the conversation here. We have been discussing the decentralization-centralization problem. We have been discussing the problems of politics and culture, as we've been looking at that, those kinds of tensions, I would like to talk a little bit about law and community. I mean, I would like to introduce that kind of a notion here, because I think that as one thinks about now global citizenship and governance, one has to think about what are those normative processes for handling conflicts, for redressing grievances, for making sure that claims of particular interest groups in a society are processed in some kind of orderly fashion so violence doesn't break out, for dealing, therefore, with the distribution of values in some equitable fashion. That's what I consider to be governance, and that's what I consider law to be, i.e., law is a process of value realizing, and I profess law the way some people profess Hagia Sophia, or whatever it is. And what I'd like to argue is that there's a kind of funny tension that people have about law and community. That is, there was the traditional argument. It's in the Marxists, it is that law is superstructure and epiphenomena, and the material base comes first. In our own society, we had Sumner who talked about mores, folkways, and custom and rules, and what they meant by that was that the sacred rules come first, then the courtesy rules, and then you get kind of an epiphenomenal, that whole business. My sense of it is that the notion of community is impossible without the notion of law. That the notion of having people who come together and not having a governance structure which determines how the values in that community will be allocated, and when there's an argument about how they will be allocated, that there is some place where you go to get that resolved in an authoritative fashion, one agreed upon by a consensual authoritative set of values. I cannot conceive of a community that does not have that. Now, you maybe say that that's legal imperialism, that I'm making too much of law in stating it that way. And yet, my sense of it is that there's too easy a dismissal of the notion of law on one, that theoretical ground that it's epiphenomenal, and two, that it is law and order, and therefore it is to be reviled and epithetized against. And that is not the case. I would argue there is very little justice without some constitutive order in a community which handles the grievances amongst ourselves in some formal authoritative way, so that the people who are involved in it really believe that what is coming out is more or less rough justice, or they would not adhere to it. Otherwise, the amount of coercive authority, what Dick was talking about this morning, the contractual agreement between the rulers and the ruled, is one in which there is sufficient agreement that you don't need a hell of a lot of coercive authority, because you've agreed that this is the way you will handle these claims and these grievances. And in that sense, I find it a false dichotomy to talk about law and community. It's the appropriate law within the appropriate community. And it's that what I want to talk about in terms of the preferred worlds. I happened to be reading Dick Falk on the way up on one of his chapters, and in one of his chapters he has suggested, and I just select these out because I happen to read them last, he suggested there are four alternative models of preferred worlds now sort of being bruited about in the U.S. scene, although we now have eight since we've got them from all over the globe, but let me just confine myself to the four of them. The four, he suggests, are the original model that I talked about, the world peace through world law, the Federalist model. The next two are two he talked about this morning, which he called the Nixon-Kissinger model, and I would call Concert of the Globe model. The third one is the Trilateral Commission or the Multinational Corporation model, and the fourth one is something I would call the Populist model. Now, the world government model or the world federalist model is the one that's probably most familiar in a sense, but just so that everybody will have it in their heads, and if we want to have a discussion about it, we can do so. It argues the following, that if you're going to have a world in which large-scale organized violence is to be eliminated, then one of the things you must do is disarm the nation state, and you must limit its capacity to rearm. In other words, you must have complete and general disarmament. Or, and put it in more mundane, if we had assembled here 200 years ago, okay, most of us would be carrying sidearms. It would be to keep away the beast and to keep away the Indians, not knowing who was going to attack us. Now, some way along the line, we decided it was better to give our security into the hands of what are now called the pigs. That is to say, we decided we would take away our sidearms and give the monopoly of the use of coercion to some kind of centralized bureaucracy, because whatever the negative, the trade-off was better than each of us having our own sidearm. Some such notion, then, it turns out, if you're going to complete and generally disarm on a global level, you better damn well set up some kind of a security system in which whatever the units of actors are, whether they're nation-state or others, and I hope there'll be a lot of others, they feel that same sense of security, at least equivalent to what most... And there is no society, there is no domestic society in the world now that does not think of itself as having a coercive authority and taking away, except New York City or Chicago, taking away the handguns from people so that they don't use them on one another, but they use it over there. And somehow, that notion, therefore, is part of the world that you're going to have complete and general disarmament, right? And you're not, and let me tell you why at this point I think law is a very radical notion, comes the 80s. To have a legal regimen in which we really would tell Nixon and Brezhnev and Mao Zedong and Tanaka and Giscard, you can't build another tank. You and your national security machinery, there is a law which says you cannot build another tank, you cannot build another weapon. That kind of law is a radical notion. Let me just tell you, therefore, that world law, if it were introduced, would be one of the most radical things we had done in the history of humankind. We are establishing a global governance, and that is a very radical in the sense of root, of changing the system, and of establishing a new normative order. There is nothing more radical than establishing law at the global basis, and incidentally making it stick on individuals, as we did at Nuremberg in Tokyo, holding individuals responsible for derelictions and not hiding behind the notion of acts of state. That is part of it. Now, if you're going to have complete and general disarmament and you're going to put up a military police force, then you better well have a court. That is to say, if you disarm people and you have policemen around, well, then what are you going to do about people who have grievances against one another? If every time we had an automobile accident, we had to resort to self-help, we would soon be back to arming one another. And therefore, you obviously got to have some kind of a compulsory jurisdiction before some kind of a tribunal, which will say, if you two have a grievance, then you'd best bring it over here, and it's got to be resolved. Mm-hmm. Now, in the particular model of world order that Messrs. Clark and Soane developed, they were very much concerned about the economic well-being of the rest of the globe. And in successive editions, they moved from $10 billion a year to $50 billion annually as a tax on the developed states of the world as a matter of right for world development at the global level. They saw that as a necessary ingredient in getting people from the underdeveloped areas of the world to become involved in that kind of a global government. That's a model of world order. It's complete and general disarmament, centralized peacekeeping, compulsory jurisdiction, and a global taxing agency, right? We can argue about it both in terms of its Frankensteinian possibility, i.e. it's going to become so great that that one's going to be worse than what we've got. And we can argue about its feasibility. Is it a politically viable kind of thing? Not only because of its Frankensteinian possibilities, and therefore some people in this room would be very much opposed to it, but will the nation state bend in that direction sufficiently so that you can bring it into being? Now, the models B and C, model of the concert of the globe, that model is rapidly taking shape. That's Kissinger running around and making sure that Peking and Moscow are open even though you've bombed Haiphong and Hanoi. That's having Peking really say to you, yes, Vietnam is a footnote in history. What is important is that we establish a relationship between the big powers of the world, and that these big powers understand that while there may be some real intense ideological conflict between them, they will never go to war amongst each other, they will use proxy clients to do that. Okay? And that there are two problems, at least one problem, and one is survival that they're willing to face despite the rhetoric, if you drop the bomb, there'll only be 400 million of us dead, 350 will still remain. And I don't think he said it to the Romanian delegate who said he said it. And there is the problem of ecological stability, which I think they're now beginning to get through their heads, which incidentally I didn't bother to put in, but has become one of the fourth values of the world order perspective. I do believe that the managerial class that run the governments of the world, i.e. the governmental, those people who are responsible for territorial, for populations within territorial units, know very well now that it is not merely a question of the destruction due to thermonuclear war, but there is a potential of destruction of their positions of responsibility, authority, wealth, and privilege if they don't do something about the ecological crisis that is about them. And they are now trying to establish some kind of a framework in which that will occur. I leave to you, because Dick talked about it, whether that's an appropriate model, either in terms of the ethics of the operation that will occur, because as he points out, it's likely to be the Brazil model, or whether it's a stable model, whether it can occur. And in that connection, it just so happened that in that marvelous newspaper we've been talking about so much, the New York Times, on the second section this afternoon, on the lower left-hand side, there was a little statement, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has moved back to their original, they've moved the clock back to where they were in 1947. They've moved back to 9 minutes to midnight, because there are five things that have occurred in the world, the salt, which is the spread of nuclear weapons, the giving of it, the explosion, the spread, all that business. And in that sense, I'm certain that the Big Five is now planning very much on how to govern that spread, despite the fact that they're giving it away, who they're going to co-opt in, how they're going to handle that, and the terrorism that may arise from that. And the ecological crisis they're now beginning to look at a little more carefully, because they understand that there are some kinds of commodities they want, that they need desperately, that they're probably going to have to share. The second model, the third model, but the second one within that thing, which I will call the Brzezinski model, or the trilateral commission model, or the multinational corporation model, arises out of a sense of the trilateral commission, in which the argument is, as Dick put it, central guidance or world government is too important to leave to the governments of the world. Somehow or other, we've got to get the prominent and thoughtful and responsible managerial elite into it, and that's why they set up the Trilateral Commission. And they brought the people from the OECD countries together to discuss what is the way we might establish a global governance in which there would be a world without borders for the multinational corporation, so that it can do its good by producing and distributing the goods the way it always has. And again, I consider that to be an intramural fight. That is the fight between B and C, whether it's the concert of the globe or whether it's the multinational corporation, seems to me to be a kind of intramural fight between those who are already running the damn system. And the question is where the emphasis will be in that kind of a resolution to the thing. Now, the fourth one, and the one on which I would hope the Lindisfarne kind of an experiment, although I must say in all candor, I don't see it yet from here, but I don't... Where we might have a really important dialogue and communication about this global governance is in this populist, in the notion that there might be a populist governance of the globe. And here I might just add to the list of heroes we've been using as our culture images. We've been using Jefferson, Maoist, Mao, and Gandhi. I was thinking about that. I'd like to add Andrew Jackson, Shastri, who had that 15-month period there, but it was a remarkable sort of Andy Jackson for India, Julius Nyerere, and Olof Palme. That is to say, I would like to somehow throw into the heroes and the images and the models we have those four as part of our culture heroes. Because... What? Who should we add? Well, if I have to think of the horror that the others have brought, I mean, if I think of the slavery in Jefferson, I mean, if I start thinking, okay, but I'll drop Jackson for you. Somebody like Andy Jackson without Seminole Indians. But what I guess what I'm trying to say is I would like us to begin to encourage the myth here by looking for people who aren't writ quite so large as those and somehow have a moral stature that comes from the fact that they are of the people, they tend to want to go back to the people in a, whoever. I mean, I don't care, you know, we'll hand out a sheet of paper, you put your list on it, and then at the end the winner gets. But at any rate, I do think that on this populist side, that the whole notion of decentralization does make a good deal of sense. I was thinking, as John was talking last night, supposing every child was schooled in whatever fashion, so that by the time he was 14 years old, he understood solar and wind energy. Okay? And that he was also given that cycle that John had showed us about how you take the fish and the algae and et cetera, so that in fact it could go off by the time he was 15 or 16 and set up his own little energy plant and his own food processing plant. Okay, that would be an absolutely incredible contribution to global governance if you knew you did not have to rely upon the local food and manufacturing and distributing thing because you had it right there. Man, that would change the way we would govern. I mean, that would be a hell of a change. Now, if there's a lot of that kind of inventive thinking about how one decentralizes, then what you have to throw into the juridical pot as to what belongs to particular political constituencies and actors would change. And it is in this connection that I would move drastically away from the nation state. It seems to me that one of the things we should be concerned about as people who are trying to vision up, as it were, the last part of this century is to move away from the nation state system and begin to think of those range of actors, subnational groups, transnational groups, regional organizations, functional groupings, which somehow get legitimate juridical status to vote, act upon, be decision makers within the important functional arenas of the world with regard to the sustenance of all humankind. Let's start off with the notion that humankind is the juridical unit. We are no longer talking about nation states. And incidentally, this is, I suppose, and I left out, is the most important of the part of the world order perspective. We are part of that Copernican revolution, which says, when you look at the globe now, and you see the set of problems facing the globe, you have already moved away from the notion of the nation state system. You're not asking, how is the nation-state system working? You're asking the question, what are the global problems? And then in answering that question, you answer the question in terms of, well, here are some processes that might, here are some actors that might help you solve those problems, and here are some that will hinder the solution. And to the extent to which the nation-state system helps you solve the problems, then you use it. To the extent to which it hinders, then you try to brush it aside and you arrange for a new set of actors to become the juridical units. And I suppose it's in that context. Let me give you three slogans before I leave. Three slogans which we can operationalize. But as I have looked through all the documents and thought about these set of global problems, if I think of what we need in the security, armed coercive field, my slogan would be, let us move away from military to police. That's the slogan. If I look at the ecological and economic well-being problem, and they are obviously very interdependent, and in that, I would move from the notion, let's move from growth to need. That's the slogan, from growth to need. And if we did, the notion of maximal limits, as well as minimals, for the lower 10%, but the notion of maximum might become a very important ingredient in the way we looked at the globe, especially with regard to the distribution of material goods. And when I think of social injustice, I think of, could we move from indignity and brutality to civility? Is there some way, and I've left out of this whole thing what is in a way very dear to my own heart, and I take one scenario which sort of illustrates the way I think about it. I conceive of as the most unjust regime in the world today, and there are many, so when you're looking for champions, that I conceive of the South African regime to be the most unjust regime in this sense. It is very difficult to get a consensus on what one means by social injustice or social justice. Is the women's liberation movement the most significant or the least significant or some middle? It is inconceivable when you think about the history of humankind, let's say from 20,000 B.C., a Toynbee-like span I'll take, down to the present, to think that half the human race has somehow been treated frequently as less than the other half for biological reasons, and then put into kinds of positions and roles where their self-definitions and our definitions don't allow them to grow to a full human being. It just sort of, you know, boggles the mind. It almost makes you think it isn't true or it wasn't true. Well, the question of whether that women's liberation movement then comes high on the list of social injustice, you know, if you really believe it. And yet, our intuition is no, that can't be. It just, and what we have to use as an operational definition then for social injustice is there a consensus of humankind, an overwhelming consensus of humankind around the rule? And it seems to me that a state in 1974 that as a public policy is practicing apartheid, discrimination based on race, is just so out of step with the normative ethic of the global culture that we can call it an outlaw nation. And if my scenario would be that we should establish a centralized peacekeeping force that would go in and apprehend the criminals who run that regime. See, we frequently think of law and order as somehow quelling those who are bringing about the good. But the fact is, what we might do is the first place we might use a centralized peacekeeping force is to establish the dignity of humankind. Those people who run that state, in my mind, are technically criminals. They are committing crimes against humanity. We established at Nuremberg and at Tokyo that those crimes are crimes, they're universalistic. It is permissible then, in fact, it is obligatory that the world community pick those individuals up, try them, and establish a new regime in that. That's how I see law and order might be used, and that's how I see in the relationship between peacekeeping and social justice, okay? That is, we want to do that. Now, it is in that context, and that's my first transition scenario. That is to say, if I have to select, which I don't because you're not urging me to do so, but I will tell you, if I have to select 5 or 10 transition proposals for the next 10 years or 5 years, apartheid would be one of them I would go heavy on, but this, let me first of all give you a set of criteria that I think are significant. Assuming that we could agree upon some preferred world, and that's an assumption contrary to fact. That is to say, we do have a sense of value sharing, of normative sharing, but we have not given any behavioral specificity to that. We've not given any incarnateness. Whether one comes to Lindisfarne or one works on 44th and 6th Avenue, jet flying around the world to see other intellectuals, we've not been able to sort that out. First, we fought about it. Now we were agreeing that we should talk, but we still don't know how to combine those. Okay, so we don't really have a concretization or incarnation of that kind of business. But if I would argue, if we had some vague sense of what a preferred world would be, then we do need a series of transition steps. And I've tried to develop some, and here are the criteria I used for developing them. I've argued that they should fit, if possible, all 5 of these criteria, but I'll settle for any one. The proposal should be based on the notion of the benefit for all of humankind or on the application of universal principles. Somehow, when you think of it, you should think of it as having applicability to global culture and global governance on a universal basis, and it's for all of humankind. Secondly, the proposal should probably, as a transition measure, highlight the inadequacies of the present operation of the existing nation-state system. You want to pick, and I'll give illustrations of each of these. You want to pick something which shows that the nation-state is incapable of dealing with that problem, or as Pope John XXIII put it in the good encyclical, with the best of intentions, the authorities that now run the nation-state system will be unable to meet the problems of security and disarmament, for the system itself is unable to do so. And you want to show that. Now, the third one I would say is that the proposals should lead to drastic system change rather than to merely reform of the present system. And that one's not so easy. Okay, it's not easy for two reasons. One is one man's reform is another man's drastic change, and one man's drastic change is another guy's tea party. It's not clear what is a drastic system change, and we need some criteria, some meta-criteria for what is drastic and what is reform. And furthermore, there's a good deal to be said for the little boy putting his finger in the dike, which is why I call my... it may be that he's holding up the whole thing. He's got the exact point in that dike where he's holding the tension off, and it'll give us some time if we merely reform the system. So that one's difficult. And it turns out I only have four. You'll be happy to hear. The proposals should have a political feasibility at what I would say the 5 to 20% level. And let me tell you what I mean by that. Any proposal that has an 80 to 100% feasibility of coming into being is uninteresting. It's just uninteresting because it's not likely to change the system. It's not likely to do anything for anybody in any sort. And just given the fact that we're in a revolutionary period, it seems to me that that's not. On the other hand, anything below 5% and you begin to feel like a fool. I mean, you want better than 1 out of 20, although I'm overstating that. I mean, maybe there are times when you want, you know, if you've got to jump 12 feet and the only way to do it is somehow find something that is a slender reed, and you, if not, you go down the chasm, you probably use it if it's 1 in 100, if that's your only alternative. But in general, I was trying to find a paradigm of criteria that would really help us sort of thing. And so what I want to argue is that you need, from as I see it, in the transition process, you need an aggregation of transition proposals. It is insufficient to work on one. Every one of us may only work on one, but we need a common strategy, because unless we aggregate the transition proposals into some kind of a critical mass, they will not be sufficiently drastic to change the system. They will be co-opted into the system, and we're back to where we were, with the people of wealth and position and privilege having learned how to accommodate to that and taking it over again. So I now offer these as to be done all together right now, as the song goes. And the first one I would start with is with the apartheid in South Africa. And then there's one that I think that we who are part of the movement have just missed dismally, and on which there was a good deal of work done, and that is the establishment of a comprehensive ocean regime. At this very moment, they are now in Caracas, 151 nation states. I saw Johann Galtung last week. He'd just come back. He says there are 7 transnationals at that meeting. Elizabeth Borghese, who started the whole thing with that group at the UN. And she said, and he says, now he's probably, there may be more than that. I'm sure there are a large number of NGOs there who are putting their oar in. But what Galtung was saying was, and let me say, tell you why I think the law of the sea is such an important one. As those of you who've gone through American political, American history and world geography know, the traditional doctrine was freedom of the seas, which meant that the sea belonged to no one. Okay, now what Elizabeth and her group around her, I use Elizabeth, but she's just a symbol. What they began to argue was that since the ocean belonged to no one, the better way to phrase it was that the ocean belonged to everyone. Okay? Now that doctrinal change, that the ocean belongs to no one and now belongs to everyone, then you get a series of conclusions from that. If it belongs to everyone, then it has to be used for the betterment of everyone. And if it's going to be used for the betterment of everyone, then you have to establish a regime which ensures that it will be used for the establishment of everyone. Okay, now, they set up a process by which the Law of the Sea conference is to be held, and it's a 12-week conference down there in Caracas. And you can tell from the limited reports, but good reports, again, from the Gray Eminence, the fascist magazine, the New York Times, the newspaper that we talked about, that nothing is happening. That what is occurring is that they'll agree on a 12-mile limit. They will agree on freedom of passage. They will agree on 200 miles out for the use of all the coastal things. And as somebody put it, by the time you set up the regime, there'll be 20 square feet out in the middle of the Pacific and Atlantic that will belong, and it will be licensed for 100 years to Shell Oil of Holland. Okay, that's what it now looks is occurring. Now, this was a real opportunity. It wasn't a sexy one, and therefore people didn't join the party. It wasn't quite as sexy as the one in Stockholm, although
I guess that's a place for sex. I know. But anyway,
there were a lot of people who showed up in Stockholm, and Stuart will give you the dismaying experience that occurred there. But one of the things that occurred is they weren't ready when they went there. All the papers were prepared by the government officials, and then the counterculture group showed up at Stockholm, and they were responding rather than sort of prepared, and they didn't have a common enterprise. They didn't know what they wanted, and therefore that one, I think we did better than we're entitled to. I think that the establishment of the UN environment, in fact, that's on my list. Give teeth to the UN Environment Agency. That's one of the things. I would start asking, how do you start giving some implementation machinery to the, that's my third one on the list, okay? After the law of the sea. Marie Strong sitting there in Nairobi. What does he need? How do we help him? What are the kinds of ways we begin to really give effective implementation? How do we give him enough money? But in the law of the sea, how do we get that back for the people of the world? How do we really get that so that with the stuff that comes out of there, the income from the stuff that comes out of there really goes into an appropriate kind of development authority? A fourth kind of an agency I think we need desperately is a global food agency. And here I don't know which way to go on. I know we need, as a minimum, a monitoring agency and some kind of food banks. I also know that we ought to establish the right to food as a legal right, and that people all over the globe should have a place where they can go and enforce that right by a writ of some sort, a writ of food giving or some damn thing. Whether we then have to move to some kind of socialist productivity throughout the globe to ensure that is something I haven't made up my mind, although I tend to, in my naive leftist infantilist way, to say yes. That is, my guess is that it would probably be appropriate. But I'm now impressed by the possibility of these decentralization things. And if it is in fact possible for all of us to learn how to grow our own food, or enough of us to learn how to grow so that it doesn't seem like an inconvenience to do it, and we could do it in fishbowls inside of our apartments on West End Avenue, then I don't know whether we need a global food. That kind of technological advance, an intermediate technology, I would buy an American way of saying that would be good. Now, I could go on, and I just want to list rather than sort of some of the things that I have left out, which I think we also have to aggregate here, is the establishment of a standby peacekeeping force and what I would call the responsibility for humanitarian intervention in large-scale civil war. And let me stop there and say a word, because that is, like apartheid, that one is one that touches me deeply. If you look at the casualties in direct violence due to large-scale organized violence since World War II, they've all occurred in the Third World. And with the exception of the United States intervention in Korea and Vietnam, they've all been between brown and black people. The only white people have really lost there was the French in Algeria, but they were there. But otherwise, okay. Now, if you look at the five great revolutions besides those Korea and Vietnam, that is to say, if you go back to Indonesia, Somaliland, Burundi, Nigeria, I'm leaving one out, you will find there were between 250,000 to 1.25 million people who were slaughtered, and I'm not talking about the deaths that were attributable to the violence within a month or 2 month period due to pestilence and starvation right away, not the 18 month even. If you add to that, it comes out that it's an incredible number of people. And what happened under all those, the Bangladesh was the other one, what happened under all those circumstances is that the global community sat by, and under some kind of crazy notion that we call domestic jurisdiction, i.e. the nation state, we refused, quote, to intervene within the domestic jurisdiction of another state. Now, it is an insanity. It is a moral insanity to let those people fight one another and rape each other and pillage each other and loot each other that way on some kind of notion. Now, why did we not do it? Because all the other nation states were concerned that if we set the precedent of intervening within, quote, that domestic jurisdiction, we would set the precedent of intervening on some other domestic.
It was the Frankensteinian monster writ large for the governments, for each government, so we didn't do it. So I would argue that some kind of humanitarian intervention under very confined rules, under what the appropriate sanctions, heavy voting majorities within the General Assembly, I don't care how we do it, but let's begin that kind of a notion. I would also argue that we probably need the beginnings of some genuine world tax scheme. And here I go to the academician Sakharov, who in his document in 1967 on freedom, coexistence, and whatever it was, progress, argued that the developed areas of the world should give 20% of their gross national income for a 20-year period to the third world. Now, that it would come from the Soviet Union in that kind of sort of blatant form, and as a matter of right, that is, that they had it coming, that it came from that kind of source was kind of an incredible thing when it did come out. But the notion that we assist each other on the globe through some kind of governance structure, not as a matter of handout, but as a matter of the fact that we've established a global political system in which people do live in various parts of the world and they are entitled to live just the way we are entitled to live. And then maybe we can have something to say about their population explosions, okay? Not before, but after we've sort of gotten into that scheme. Now, those are a set of aggregate kinds of transition proposals that I think we should be engaged in. They are only programs. They do not yet talk about the actual political process, about how we become involved in them, okay? Because I've not yet said what is the transition process itself. And I don't have any... I didn't have any miracles up until now, so I'm not going to end with a miracle. I don't have any brilliant kind of way to talk about that other than to say it seems to me that the educative process that we're all engaged in, the consciousness raising, should go around these set of issues, an agreement about these set of issues. I'm not arguing against the kind of cultural transformation that comes out of spirituality and Renaissance and consciousness about one another. But I am arguing that there might be involved in each of our learning some expertise. We keep arguing about how the heck, we don't want to give this over to the expert. We don't want to give this over to the technocrat. Well, if we don't, then we better do it ourselves. I mean, if they're not going to do it, who's going to do it? And that's the point. Somehow we have got to do it. And these aren't, they're not fun to learn about. But they're very important for those people who want to see the world in a sane and just fashion. So I would argue there's the educative process, and then there's the beginning of the establishment of functional units on a global basis, transnationally oriented, who are in sufficient touch with one another to know how they bring pressures to bear in their own societies, to see to it that whoever votes on those matters votes the way you want them to vote. Well, that's just plain old political pressure. It's very mundane. It's back to political process. I wish there were some other way. I mean, I wish somehow that we could confront all of these ongoing problems and with some other form of social movement. I do not deny the necessity for the myth, for the infusion of the spirit. I think that's probably what we all stand on. And I guess my Hasidic Jewish background is coming to the fore and wanting all of these things that they should all sing at once at the same time. Those are the new angels. To think that I would think that UNCTAD might be an angel singing for me, it's difficult to believe. But nevertheless, to promote life into those things of a populist variety, of the kind of communes that are established all over, that seems to me what is important if we're going to really get through this transition process. Thank you.
First of all, let me thank you, Saul, in the name of all of us, for a very interesting presentation. I'm sure that there are many here who have much more important comments to make on it and more profound questions to ask, but since I've been asked to make the start, first of all, I'd say that I'm sure it's very interesting for most of us to hear someone speak who not only has so long-standing experience with these problems, but is in a position where he can do something about it, about these problems. And so the first question is, what can we do about it? And you really suggested that we might be able to do something. And more specifically, how can we help our own conscience raising about these matters, apart from what you have helped us to do right here? And how can we help others to raise their conscience about these matters? And then, what practical suggestions do you have about organizing for action? That's one, two questions that could proliferate in the whole set of practical questions. But then also I have another set of questions which have to do with a certain skepticism as to how some of these things could actually be implemented. For instance, you, whatever models you had for desirable or preferred worlds seemed to presuppose a great deal of centralization. And I think that some of us will feel that there's a tremendous danger in this centralization. Yes, you also spoke about counterbalancing this by decentralization of a certain kind, but I'd like to hear a little more about that. And then another thing, somehow you seemed to you seem to assume that all of us are better than we actually are. There is a great deal of greed and well, greed particularly, that will not allow us to make the sacrifices that will be necessary to accomplish many of the things that are absolutely presupposed. What can one do? Do you really believe that people are willing to make the sacrifices, for instance, with regard to food? Because what John Todd suggested last night, while it holds out certain promises, implies also very great sacrifices. He isn't offering us steak dinners there. I have never tasted those fish, but he says they are good, but if you have nothing but those fish for a long time...
You keep changing the sauce.
I don't know where you take the sauce from, but anyway.
That's what old cuisine will do.
Well, those are really two areas. On the one hand, just how do you implement it practically, and secondly, how about human nature as it is, and what presuppositions do you make with regard to that?
Well, on the question as to whether I think you're better than you are, or myself that I'm better than you are, I think most people would feel foolish except from a cathartic and sort of self-purging kind of way, I think most people would feel foolish in doing a sacrifice which is meaningless. And what do I mean by meaningless? That is, they don't see how it contributes to transforming the system, and therefore why do it? And one person doing it, they don't take the Zen statement, the lifting of a finger changes, alters the stars, seriously, I take it. And I guess most people would not. So what I would argue in that context is that if we're really going to be serious about that sacrifice, I'm not sure that we don't need some critical mass of people who begin the movement. Okay, that means, therefore, political mobilization. And whether the political mobilization comes through a series of small demonstration units, or whether they come from people on Wall Street deciding that they will no longer go to a certain place to eat, or my children giving up, heavens forbid, McDonald's, because it's... And instead of having over 15 billion, and now it stops. You know, the growth, it's no longer over 15 billion sold. It's next year it's still 15 billion. What I think it requires is a fair amount of political mobilization around a particular act, which, if it did occur, would immediately translate itself into something that would be meaningful and that people could see. Now, I could see that we could even abstain from eating McDonald's and nothing would happen, that the system would co-opt it in the following sense. We would cut, because there was less demand, we would cut down in supply, and the supply and demand curve would wind up at the same place, price would, and we would maximize profits. So it obviously has to be thought through carefully enough so that when people get involved in the thing, they see that it is something that will really have a meaningful impact on the system. I don't know where many of those things have been worked out. Okay, I really don't know where they've been worked out. On the other hand, the law of the sea requires just time. That is, it requires the energy to put it in your head, and then it requires your getting in touch with John Stevenson, who's legal counsel for the State Department, who's our representative there, and hounding him with your, that's old-time political pressure. That's a different kind of sacrifice. That is a sacrifice that forces you to leave prayer, to leave the cinema, to leave the nightclub, and to say, I will devote myself to that, and I will energize myself in that direction. Now, that's a different kind of sacrifice. Not all kinds of sacrifices have to be sacrifices of the flesh. They can be sacrifices of leisure time, of recreation, of that kind of business. And the kinds I were giving, I admit, didn't require the kind of mortification of flesh or the kind of individual salvation kinds of things. They require a fair amount of deciding you're going to give up a lot of the things you would ordinarily like to do as ordinary human beings. I think a lot of us have got to become... Now, it so happens, I must confess, for people like myself, it's generally fun. And I'm not... In fact, I would put it the other way around. I understand the sacrifice element to it. And there is something to be said for knowing you sacrifice. My own experience has been, for the past 12 or 14 years, I would not have changed what I had been doing in terms of my day-to-day activity for any other kind of an enterprise, because what I was doing turned out to be really fun. That is, I think it was serious. I mean, I think the people we were engaged in this enterprise really thought we were doing something. I think we did have some impact in some places. I don't know whether it's going to transform the system. But I enjoyed doing what I was doing and got genuine joy and satisfaction from it. So one thing I would argue is that while the sacrifice aspect is important, the joy part is important too. And you will get a great deal of satisfaction and joy from getting involved with like-minded people who would like to see those changes come about and winning a few instead of constantly seeing them and having despair. Now, on the issue of skepticism and the danger of centralization, you have to be more specific. I really, because as I see it, the problem is decentralization. As I see it, first of all, let me put it in. If we have chaos and disorder come the middle of the 80s, the people who will be hurt most are the weak, the oppressed, the poor. That is, the people who have wealth, privilege, and power will be able to hold on to it and they'll maintain it. So I'm a little bit concerned about staying decentralized and disorder and chaos. Furthermore, we are moving very rapidly towards some centralization system. The only question is, what kind of a centralization system? And therefore, if you will tell me the danger that you're concerned about, I will begin to work with you on the kind of response to it. But let me be even more specific. One of the reasons I find the model, World Peace Through World Law, such an instructive model, is it establishes a centralized world police force of somewhere between 200,000 to 600,000 human beings. It then goes through the most meticulous detail on how those police will be recruited, what kind of training they will have, how long they will be involved and where they are, where they will be located throughout the world, the kinds of weapons they will be permitted to use, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. With what kind of review by civilian authority, that is to say, they're very much concerned with the Frankensteinian monster, and have come up, therefore, with a paradigm on how you might handle that Frankensteinian monster. So when you say, I'm very much concerned with centralization, tell me what aspect of centralization, give me the scenario that might play itself out, and then let's try to treat it as we would in a constitutional convention. What kind of critical review board, what kind of processes do we need to handle that? And that's why I think we need more concretization. We cannot leave our social anxieties that vague and ill-defined. We really must sort of state them so that we can meet them.
Well, it's, I would think that concretely, on the basis of what we have just recently gone through, probably some of us think, what is going to happen if you have some sort of world government and the wrong person gets into the head post or something like that? What safeguards are set up? Is it possible on a very large scale to have laws that can be enforced and so forth? That's probably one of the basic questions.
Well, it turned out that on this one we won.
Yeah.
Okay. So that in hindsight. But furthermore, I think one way to think about all of this when you're talking about centralization, decentralization, is to ask yourself, what is the likely alternative? I mean, there's one way to evaluate and judge finally what the system you come up with is. What is the likely alternative if this one doesn't win? And as I see what will win, as I see the centralized system that it's about to win, that's much worse. Now, if you think there's more play in that one, there's more leverage, there's more running around, then you will opt for some modified Brazilian model, as Dick would have put it. I don't think that that's going to be a very nice place to live in. In fact, I think it's going to be a terrible place to live in. And I would rather than force my governance structure throughout the globe to begin to think of themselves as being contained by a rule of law. Now, that doesn't mean that in 2050 I wouldn't be in the movement to break up world government, break up the Yankees. That is, I could see myself. See, the one point that Dick made this morning, we don't think of this as the end of history. We're talking about a moment in time when a new kind of culture is emerging, a planetary culture and a governance. That governance has to meet that cultural setting. It has to do it, we hope, in an ethical way. Well, we set up the governance. Now, I'm enough of a constitutional man to know that you don't change constitutions overnight, although both Mao and Jefferson seem to think every 20 years you'd better do it, because otherwise the bureaucrats will get you, right? They'll stick it to you. Well, okay, we may need such a... We may be even bright enough to build that into our constitutional model. We may be able to say, every 20 years we will have a review of this model, and if we don't pass a new one, we'll revert to 1972. Okay, that's something like that. But it is precisely that kind of question at a specific level. What is it that you see that could occur? And then I will try to dream up with you the kind of device and process that you think would be a sufficient safeguard, again, weighing it against the alternative model as you see it coming down the road, or the alternative history of it coming down the road. And as for the implementation, I really can't say much more than what I said before. I do think that it requires a good deal more attention and education to politics. I'm afraid we're in politics, and I'm afraid it's got to be informed politics. Informed, you know, by grace as well as by savvy, but nevertheless informed by savvy and clout and the kind of people that... We had a little rehearsal. Take you backstage now. And he was telling me about a group of sisters that have organized themselves in Washington, and they've turned out to be just an interest group. And they spend their time learning about the particular bill that they want to see lobbied through, and then they go around wearing their garb or not their garb, depending on, I suppose, on the tactical situation, and lobbying that thing. Well, that's doing God's work, as I see it. Okay, and I don't know how to get around that.
Personally, I've come to feel that I can't save anybody, not even myself, in one sense. In fact, I can't even help anybody who's not about 5 minutes away from helping themselves. That is, the people that I feel that I can help are the people who have worked to bring themselves to a point where they're just about 5 minutes away from being inspired or taking some assistance from what I can say or do. Anybody else, I've discovered for myself that it's an illusion for me to think that I can help them. That really the only thing that I can do practically is to work on myself. And that in doing that, I discover that there are connections, unbelievable ones, that connect me with everyone else. that are a little difficult to see from one level, but the problem is in the seeing, that they really do exist and they really are there. But that the most practical thing that I can do for anybody else is to really put my house in order. And so that when we're talking about world management and global government and thinking about these things, I would very much respond and appreciate if from time to time we could bring a discussion back to a personal husbanding of our own household energy, so to speak. That is, what is involved in really doing work on oneself, so that we can get to a place where we don't have to say yes, yes to Paul's statement, oh, wretched man that I am, the good that I would I can't, and what I wouldn't that I do. Because as long as we're in a place where we have to say that's me, then we have to say that the violence and the turmoil and the conflict that we see outside is still going on inside of us, and anywhere we go, anywhere I go, as long as I assent to that statement, I'm going to bring that same thing with me, whether it be in my talk or in my action. And so that until I can bring harmony into my own life, I can't bring harmony anywhere else.
Well, I respect that view, but I don't think it's true of everybody. And I think it's a mistake to lay it on everybody.
I was speaking for myself.
No, I understand that, but I want to. But it's said in the it's a serious statement. It's a statement about how we should proceed now with regard to these ills, this dis-ease that each of us feels. And I don't know why some people feel the commitment to the race more than to themselves, if one can say it that way. Your arguments are that the way you get the real commitments to the race, i.e., to the species, is through finding out yourself and getting that peace and repose. And that anything other than that is counterproductive and dysfunctional. I don't know if that's because, if that's what follows from it, I would argue that you leave out a huge segments of the human race from time immemorial and likely to be in the future. And they have cripples though we may be, and blind though we may be, we have contributions to make. And while I understand and respect the position that there are people who must, first of all, find that repose in themselves before they go out and help others or deign to really interfere, is what it amounts to. There are others who either don't have the capacity or see it differently, and we shouldn't lay it on them. Because there is no indication that social and individual disorganization are that highly correlated. A lot of social disorganization, you frequently have very well put together people because of the social system and vice versa. I mean, if you look, unfortunately, at the data, it doesn't show up the way you say. They're in all four cells.
With your permission, since Chairman aren't supposed to talk, but just for the sake of highlighting the argument and becoming practical, I'd like to focus on the other side of a strategy, because I think both Saul and Dick Falk today have presented us Cirrus on a planetary scale, a vision of catastrophe and tragedy, and they have shown the other side of the chasm and said this is the preferred world, but as Carl and others have pointed out, and Brother David, there's a transitional strategy missing on how we get there. So I'd like to just focus on the way in which I think that this seemingly mystical kind of epiphenomenal ideological response is actually not, and it's very political and it's very practical and is a transition strategy. If you take the food crisis and you say we've got to solve the food crisis, and if you begin to conceive of it on industrial and planetary terms, and you go into monolithic agriculture, you industrialized foods and large centralizing concerns trying to ship and distribute food, you're going at it with one whole set that is very much the same kind of system that you're trying to move out of, that John Todd was demonstrating. The forces that have shaped the modern world are the charisma of cities. People went from the country to the cities because the cities was where the cathedral was, the university, and the marketplace, and the elites. So urbanization is one of the forces that have shaped the modern world. Going along with urbanization has been nationalism and the kind of figure-ground relationship of the city-state and the nation-state, as Christendom disintegrated and commercial civilization arose, and the commercial civilization was based on national markets and selling your goods across boundaries and making gold and storing the gold back home. So there's been an economic base to nationalism and urbanization. Going along with that is industrialization. Now, if you really want to change the political structure, you have to address yourself to urbanization, industrialization, and nationalism. You have to realize that what generates that is a value system and a view of reality that's based on the fact that cities have charisma and wealth and power have charisma. The very first thing you have to do then is to separate and take charisma away from wealth by creating a new culture in which wealth does not have charisma. Here again, I point to Einstein as the great prophet of our era who used his paycheck from Princeton as a bookmark. In this sense, I think he's, you know, a great sage of the new planetary culture. The second thing you have to do is the thing that the corporate system that interlocks urbanization, nationalism, and nationalism, urbanization, and industrialization is the university, and the charisma of the post-industrial world of think tank, research consortium, and the shift away from a traditional common law or jurisprudence or humanistic or religious tradition to a positivistic social science, value-free, neutral, modernizing force, grabbing up those traditional nations and putting them into some interlocking corporate system. So the way you have to go about it is take charisma away from wealth and then take it away from the university, because the university is the central nervous system of the modern world we're talking about. There's no possible way we can begin to criticize this if we are still, in some sense, civil servants of the state at high salaries and highly charismatic posts flying around in research tanks from one nation to another and giving ourselves as models of what the new world is supposed to be. So when John Todd undersold that windmill in Uganda last night and said, you don't want this, this is for us, it's not for you, and all of a sudden he said, what do you mean it's not for us, it's for you, and all of a sudden they're building windmills, he knew exactly the kind of psychology. We are elites, we must recognize our responsibility as elites, and if we begin to get rid of the culture of wealth where wealth has charisma, cities have charisma, universities and think tanks and consortiums have charisma, and move out from that and separate authority from power, and then embody a new kind of vision of cultural transformation where we decentralize, where we grow our own food, where we take on our children back into the value base and have the schools very much as part of the way of life, as you see with the kids around here at Lindisfarne, and do not ship them off into giant public school systems where they're administered tranquilizers for hyperactive kids and behavioral modification and all the trappings of the modern world. If we address ourselves to those things, then we are very specifically taking away the underpinnings of the whole modern world. If we simply go back into the political process and say we have to organize and bureaucratize and form the Democratic Party and create a system, everything Dick was saying this morning led in the direction of the authoritarian world state run by good guys who will take land and food away from these people and distribute it equitably. It's the H.G. Wells vision of the world, and I think that's going to go right into its opposite. I think one thing, and I'll end with this, one thing we should remember in terms of historical process is things that begin in one position often end in their exact opposite. That a cure for epilepsy can become psychosurgery and ESB, that the man who created a pill to increase woman's fertility created the contraceptive pill, that in point of fact, the technology that John Todd created as a man in the war movement moving away from being a scientist in large think tank government-sponsored research can be very easily absorbed by NASA and be turned into how to create microenvironments in hermetically sealed containers and make human beings and plants, potted plants, in hothouses. So that too, by an enantiodromia, can go right into its opposite. We have seen medicine create illness and the Green Revolution create the agricultural desiccation of India, and we have seen, in some sense, American medicine create more millions of people to die. We have to stop a moment and go back to the drawing board and say, why is it that we try to act with the best of intentions and the exact opposite happens?
Well, I must say, just sort of, it sounds a little flippant, but if you will assure me that my world government will wind up with decentralization, which is, I understand what your remarks are about, then I'm all for world government, because you just said to me that things that start frequently turn out the other way, and therefore, as I understand it, yours is going to turn out tyrannical, mine's going to turn out decentralized. And my God Almighty, okay, that's a debater's point, and I don't want to win that way. Okay, I'm smart. Okay, now look. Now, I do want to make a point about...